Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 173. John O'Neill, our director of performance and co-owner at Cressy Sports Performance Massachusetts, is actually filling in as a guest host this week. He's talking to a former CSP intern who has done some amazing things, both in performance physical therapy in the strength and conditioning world, but also with some really impressive backgrounds in the U.S. military. Just a wonderful guy. And I think he's got an excellent perspective, on return to play, big picture strategies that can be applied, not just in baseball populations, but across the whole athletic community. Really good information here. I think you're really going to like him. So enjoy. This episode is brought to you by AG1, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it can be difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can often wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where AG1 can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. That's why I use it daily, as do several of my family members, and we recommend it to a lot of our top athletes. One scoop of AG1 contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients that work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet to support energy, focus, digestion, and recovery. And this can all happen for less than $3 per day and without taking multiple products. While most nutritional supplements come to market and stay stagnant, AG1 continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing over 50 improvements in the last decade alone. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best-tasting nutrition habit on the planet. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, it'll work for you, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar per serving. They put 75 ingredients through the rigorous NSF certification test to come up with a safe formula that's trusted by some of the world's top athletes, including many of our own at Cressy Sports Performance. Right now, AG1 is giving our listeners a special offer of 10 free travel packets with their first purchase. Just head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim this special offer. These travel packets are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health while you're traveling for games, training, or simply on the go. They can be great counterbalance to the less than ideal on the road food options that are out there for a lot of our traveling baseball players. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance of getting nutrient diversity, head to drinkag1.com/Cressy to get 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. You won't regret it. Today's guest is a physical therapist and CEO and co-founder of Resilient Performance Systems. Resilient seeks to systematically explore the continuum between acute rehabilitation and athletic performance. Resilient's clients include athletes and operators from Major League Baseball, the NBA, professional mixed martial arts, the X Games, the Winter and Summer Olympics, Major League Lacrosse, the NCAA, federal law enforcement tactical teams, military special operations forces, and those with a history of persistent pain and extensive surgical backgrounds. Resilient also advises organizations about medical and performance staffing, program development, and injury risk mitigation strategies. Before beginning his sports medicine practice, he was a pararescue man in the U.S. Air Force, where he deployed throughout the world to help provide technical rescue capability and emergency care to U.S. and allied forces. He's a nationally certified paramedic with advanced training in emergency, trauma, and wilderness medicine. In 2015, he was selected as one of the U.S. Air Force's Outstanding Airmen of the Year. In the spring of 2011, he served as a strength and conditioning intern at Cressy Sports Performance in Massachusetts. He received his AB in biology from Brown University and master's in exercise physiology and doctorate of physical therapy from Columbia University. Please welcome to the show, Doug Kakijian.
Welcome to the Elite Baseball Development Podcast. My name is John O'Neill. I'm here with a good friend of mine, Doug Kakijian, who is a co-owner of Resilient Physical Therapy based in the New York City area. I'll let Doug introduce himself a little more than that, but I've known Doug for probably 7 or 8 years. He's an excellent clinician, and I'm excited to have him on the podcast today to talk through some of the stuff that he's working on, not only in his background, but currently working on with a book that he's in the process of writing. So Doug, how are you doing today?
Yeah, doing great, John. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So your name initially came up as a good podcast guest because of your background through CSB, through Cressy. So you interned here in 2010. We were putting together a list of like, hey, who are former interns that we can have on the podcast? Yours came up. So before we, you know, get into the rest of your background, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what attracted you to choosing this internship and then, you know, takeaways that you still carry with you today?
Yeah, totally. I mean, so that was, like you said, 2010. I mean, at that point, I'd been following like Eric's work, Tony Gentilcore's work, and some of the other coaches at CS, or at the time, Cressy Performance, their work for a while. And, you know, these were some of the people who were like very early on in the internet putting out really good information. I mean, now the internet is a totally different space when it comes to our field, and there's a lot of good and a lot of bad, right? But back then, you had people like where it wasn't like kind of a get rich quick scheme to be on the internet. It was really more just like thoughtful coaches who were just sharing what they were doing and being transparent. And so, yeah, some of the, like I said, Eric and Tony were some of the people who were really early on doing that and putting out great information. And so, you know, the kind of the more I followed their work, ended up kind of on the landing page for the facility. And I just saw somewhere that they had an internship. And, you know, I mean, the advice I give anybody as far as like career stuff is, especially in our field, I'm like, who's doing what you want to do? And then just try to learn from those people. And so, you know, they were kind of doing what I wanted to do as far as like, I knew I wanted to go to PT school. And even though, you know, the facility was more strength coach oriented, I thought that, you know, they had a unique approach in that they were like basically, you know, pretty savvy about like movement analysis and working with injured athletes. And I just think that, you know, training people intelligently, and even though they were getting people stronger and faster, they were doing it in a way where they were more, you know, mindful of orthopedic health and movement quality. And I felt like had a pretty seamless system where they were kind of blending all those things together. And so I knew that I would learn a lot. And I, at the time, you know, I'd been accepted to physical therapy school. So this is the spring, I guess, of 2010. So the fall of 2010 was when I was going to start physical therapy school. So I knew that I was going to get a lot of the clinical training in the formal program. But, you know, it was a great experience because I remember the first day of my internship was at the time the busiest day in the history of the facility. It was probably, you know, late January, early February, when you had all the minor league baseball players, college baseball players. And it was, I mean, I got to do a lot of coaching. It probably wasn't as structured as it is now with you. And there's, you know, there's pros and cons to that, but it was kind of like, hey, like put your feet to the fire and start coaching. And, you know, we weren't responsible as interns for doing the programming, but we were responsible for implementing the programming, coaching the exercises. And even though there were a lot of very high level people, whether it was like collegiate and pro, we're also working with, you know, eighth graders, high school athletes. So, you know, if you can teach, you know, a middle schooler to do a good front squat or deadlift or whatever else was on the program, coaching a pro athlete's easy, especially because they had been in that system for a long time. So just, I got really good at coaching exercises, identifying kind of like what does good look like. And at the time, I remember kind of thinking to myself, oh, you know, I wish while I was here, I could write some of the programs. But looking back, I'm glad that I didn't get to do that because actually, I learned how to coach. And for 4 months, that was my only responsibility. And like, you can, you know, you've got your whole life to learn. So I felt like if I was more responsible for the writing the actual programs and not so much the coaching, I would have missed out on something. And it's kind of, you know, the Mike Boyle line, you've got to be a factory worker before you can be an artist. And that's what we were, you know, just coaching sometimes hundreds of athletes in a day. But I mean, I fall back on that experience all the time just because, you know, that was kind of like my initial coaching internship where I was, it wasn't academic, like you're actually doing it and had to figure out what works, what doesn't work with different populations. And there's all these academic discussions about cueing and internal versus external. And that stuff is great, but like reading a research paper about cueing is not nearly as impactful as having to work with all those different athletes, you know, in a kind of a chaotic setting. So, you know, even though now I've learned a bunch more since, like as far as like my fundamentals as a coach and a clinician, just knowing like, again, what good movement looks like, how to coach basic exercises. I fall back on that all the time. And the more I learn, the more I appreciate like how valuable that experience was, because I feel like I always go back to those basics. And even though I've got more tools to dig from in my toolbox, it's like a lot of it's really just knowing how to go back to what I learned initially at that facility and just and getting people to do those basic things really well, even though I have more ways to funnel them into that. Like I'm doing a lot of the same things I was doing as an intern in 2010, but just in a physical therapy setting.
Yeah, that's an awesome answer. A lot of detail within it. And one of the things that stood out to me, so you mentioned like, oh, maybe the internships, you know, changed in some ways, you know, it might be a little bit different, but the common feedback I'll get with, you know, at the end of the first week, I'll talk to the interns like, hey, how do you feel like this week is going for you? And it's like, I can't believe how much you guys just like threw me out there and you know, tried to experience it and tried to figure it out. And it's like, well, if you can coach when you're uncomfortable, it only gets easier when you're comfortable, when you are, you know, doing the assessments and writing the programs and you have a better, a longer term relationship with the athlete, it only gets easier from there. So like that initial coaching experience is as hard as it gets, and then it does stick with you. And one of the things you mentioned too, that I thought was interesting, you talked about, you know, being exposed to just a bunch of different things that are, you know, combined in a system. So I know you guys at Resilient do that really well, and you guys have your Movement Foundations course, and you guys, I think, have 3 locations at this point. Am I correct on that?
We actually have a couple more. We have some satellite ones, but we basically have 2 main locations, then a few kind of like satellite locations. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that kind of goes right hand in hand. So you guys have your Movement Foundations course with like you, Greg, and Trevor originally, Greg Spatz and Trevor Rappa. And then I know you guys have employees at multiple locations. So how do you go about scaling your thought process and making sure that you, your clinicians are up to speed with what you would want your brand to represent?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, the bigger you get and the more you scale, the harder that is to do well. I mean, we're lucky in that pretty much anybody that we've brought on, like as a hire, we've either known them really well personally, or they've done like one of their physical therapy school rotations with us, which is basically like where they have kind of like with you guys, they have like 3 or 4 months to kind of follow us. And then, you know, it starts out where it's more just like observational, and then it's doing something under, you know, our guidance. And then ultimately we want them to be kind of treating independently. So they kind of get that, you know, it's kind of like a crawl, walk, run. But the easy thing is, like, until very recently, we never really had to do a job interview where we're going in blind to the public and saying like, we have a vacancy or we have a position to fill, you know, we're taking all comers. It was more like we anticipated that we were going to have a need, and we identified someone that like kind of excelled in our internship while they were in physical therapy school. And we said, hey, you know, like, what do you think about potentially working with us, you know, when you graduate? We're anticipating that there's going to be a need. And if it wasn't, like I said, a student, it was someone that we had a really close personal relationship with. So that's really easy to do when you're small. You don't have hundreds or thousands of employees. You can kind of take a much more like decentralized, less structured approach. Now, as we're getting bigger and we kind of have to sort of react to more things, we want to systematize what we do a little bit better, which would probably entail, you know, still kind of like, because we have a pretty good network, you know, we're most people that we would be introduced to initially, we have some connection with, even if it was just through kind of like knowing someone that they work with or reference, and then probably like have kind of like an initial sort of, I wouldn't even want to call it an interview, but a discussion to make sure that like, at least philosophically, their approach kind of mimics ours. Like, we don't want to micromanage how people treat and say like, you know, you must do these exercises in this sequence. We want to make sure at least like philosophically, we're kind of, you know, united by the same principles. And then, you know, from there, that'll be kind of like the first round. Then maybe the second round would be, and we're still kind of like going through this now and trying to formalize it, but maybe giving someone like in more of a formal interview setting, a case study that they can prepare for. And so like, all right, you've got, you know, a particular athlete with a particular injury, sort of, you know, here's the setting that they're in, whether it's like collegiate, high school, a timeline, if there's a time constraint, maybe some different like constraints as far as you've got to communicate with a coach or a parent, and like, how do you navigate sort of, you know, the communication piece of it. But, you know, what do you, they don't have to get super detailed as far as like sets and reps, but what is your progression for this injury? how are you going to navigate some of the, like, the political, you know, complexities, whether it's like with a parent or a coach or front office, that kind of a thing. Just so we have an idea of, like, concretely, what are the things that they do? Because, you know, if you're talking about principles, a lot of people can agree on principles, but the ultimate thing is, like, show me what you would actually do with somebody, without, again, getting overly granular. But, like, if it's a running athlete, like, what's your sort of return to run approach? And if someone says, well, you know, it's pretty much like I'm an alter G person versus I like doing track and field drills, like, that those are two much different things. So, you know, we want to tease that out. And then, you know, once we have an idea of what someone would do, like in a case study, and have kind of more concrete data on their philosophy, and then try to maybe narrow down the candidates from there. But that's something we're working on now, is how to formalize it and make it more structured, because you can only go so far with relying on people that you know, if your internship program can't, you know, produce people as quickly as you might need new staff members, and you have to look to the outside. That's what we're trying to figure out now.
Sure. That makes a ton of sense. I know it's a process that I'm sure a lot of small business owners are going through. I feel like, especially within the last couple of years, I don't know if that's a post-COVID change of maybe less in-person internships or less schools requiring in-person internships, but definitely I've talked to, you know, a handful of other small business owners, and that is a common theme. Like, how do we get people up to speed if we don't have them in front of us in person? One of the things you touched upon in there is this idea of, like, communicating with a sport coach, communicating, you didn't mention communicating with a strength coach, but I'm going to throw that in there because kind of in the same philosophy here. So let's say you get a patient, and you can pick the sport, but what is your ideal communication look like between you and their trainer, or you and their strength coach?
Yeah. And I didn't mention that because we don't have a lot of people that have strength coaches, but if we did, certainly that would be a key piece. The biggest thing is, again, when it's a professional relationship, I want to, like, respect their expertise and not immediately come in. Cause I think there's sometimes a perception like, oh, like PT should be telling the strength coach what to do. And a lot of PTs don't have a background in performance training or strength and conditioning. So, you know, I think that maybe they should be providing some guardrails and constraints as to maybe here are the things that I wouldn't do. But beyond that, I feel like you should trust the coach to know what their role is, and, like, don't micromanage them and tell them, you know, if it's someone you want to get, like, ramp back up to running, like, don't tell the strength coach what the running progression should be. Maybe tell them, like, hey, you know, I want to keep their volume at, like, this level, maybe for these couple of weeks. But beyond that, I just feel like more of a kind of like a, here's what I wouldn't want to do kind of a thing, versus saying, here's exactly what you should do, and just respecting their expertise and their professionalism. So, you know, and it goes both ways, right? Like, I don't want necessarily another professional telling me how to do my job. And conversely, I try to be respectful and not tell other people how to do theirs. But so it's really just trying to be transparent and say, like, hey, here are the things that, you know, I found that I think are important. And probably the things that, like, if I was responsible for this, for somebody, for their strength and conditioning, like, maybe the things that I would look out for. But beyond that, it's kind of like, here, it's all you. If I can be a resource to you and you want to bounce ideas off me, like, let's do that. But I try not to come in too hot and sort of dictate what should be done, because I think that's typically, like, the worst way to start off a relationship is by sort of being a know-it-all.
Sure. That makes total sense. And a lot of what we talked about so far is, you know, intra-staff communication, whether it's you with employees, you with students, or external communication. So you with other coaches, other clinicians. I want to get into a little bit of, like, this idea of you with a client. So, or you with a patient. So let's say, you know, regardless of the injury, and you can be a little more specific and pick which injuries you want to talk about. But what are the commonalities in your assessment process from between new patients, regardless of the injury? So what are the things that you're looking at in every eval and the big rocks or the KPIs, if you will?
Yeah. So, I mean, if it's like a traumatic injury where someone's like, hey, I was playing, you know, a high school football game over the weekend, I felt a pop in my knee, and they come in on crutches, then it's really more about, like, all right, like, let me look at your knee and try to make sure that this is determine if this is, like, a structural issue where you need to go see an orthopedist, or whether it's more of, like, a functional issue where it's like, all right, like, maybe, you know, it's just more muscular and the kind of thing where, like, my skill set is conducive to remedying it. Taking, like, trauma out of it and something very acute, I mean, regardless of whether someone comes in with like neck pain or knee pain or foot pain, I'm going to do like a gross movement screen just to make sure that like, let's look at like just some gross multi-joint movements. And then I'm also going to look at like, how do they move an individual joint? So, you know, like for everyone, even if they're coming in with like a lower body injury, I'm going to have them like, just do like cervical flexion, extension, rotation, just because like I'm treating the entire human and not just a body part. And I want to make sure that even though I think, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that like their foot pain is being caused by their neck, I just want to make sure that like, we don't have any things that might be limiting kind of like what my program or interventions would be later on. And so I'm doing that, like those kind of like, just, you know, individual kind of a joint assessment and a gross movement type screen with everybody, you know, because even if someone has like knee pain, I'm going to look at their hips and I want to see, do they have internal external rotation? Do they have hip flexion? Because just as a human being and a next step above that as an athlete, like these are things that you presumably should have if you want to have options in your sport and the thing that matters to you. But then I'll do a little bit more of a focused assessment depending on what their complaint is. So if it's like, if it's the foot, I might do, you know, I might look at the foot in a little bit more depth than I would a different joint. But even just doing things like, you know, passive range of motion on the painful joint can be very diagnostic. I mean, I know there's like hundreds of special tests, but the reality is like, if you've worked with enough people, you know what a healthy joint feels like compared to like an injured joint. And even just doing passive range of motion and looking at end feel, I think that can be as diagnostic and valuable as doing a special test. And when you look at the research on some of these special tests, they're oftentimes not that specific or sensitive anyway. And then, you know, I also like a lot of times the intervention itself or the training, if you will, is diagnostic and part of the assessment. So if someone says, you know, like I have shoulder pain, doing whatever, I can do all the stuff on the table in the world, but you know, I'll have them go through like different types of push-up progressions, and I might even have them to like a landmine press or just, you know, things that like I would normally want them to do in an upper body training session. And if they tell me like, okay, like everything that I do hurts, floor press hurts, a landmine hurts, then kind of like my antenna are up a little bit, because typically those are things that even in someone who might have some shoulder pain are pretty well tolerated. So if someone says, you know, like, yeah, like it hurts when I like bench press with a barbell and I watch them bench press and like their, you know, their elbows are flared out and they're getting like a ton of, you know, shoulder extension and a ton of anterior shoulder stress, but then they do that and it hurts, but I have them do a floor press with more of like a neutral grip, like kind of elbows tucked in, that doesn't hurt. It's like, all right, well, at least for now, you've got like kind of an upper body pressing option that's not provocative. But if I kind of go through all of my regressions and like everything hurts, and when you work with enough people, you're like, okay, typically with this presentation, like these things aren't painful, and you kind of give them some way to make, you know, off ramp themselves from their symptoms. If like none of those off ramps work, then I'm more likely to maybe want to refer somebody out. Cause it's like, all right, you literally can't do like everything that we do here is painful. Whether it's like a landmine, a floor press, a push up regression, even like just a, you know, a basic, like, you know, banded rotator cuff exercise, whatever, that's when I'm more likely to want to refer out, because there should be something that person should be able to do in a functional sense that's not symptomatic. And if everything is symptomatic, it leads me to believe that maybe there's something more structural going on, or that's more of a case for imaging. It's a little bit of a judgment call, right? And just pattern recognition. I can't tell you like, here's what I do for every person, but it's a combination of, you know, doing the kind of like the gross movement stuff, looking at individual joints, honing in on where their complaint is, and then just putting them through kind of like what the treatment session would be or the interventions, and just that trial and error. Because again, like the whole, you know, like the living movement screen, like everything we do is kind of diagnostic and the table can only tell us so much. And I think that a lot of times we have this false sense of precision where we're like, all right, if I do this one test, it's going to tell me whether someone has this or that. And like, I don't think that I'm that good. I don't think most people are that good. I like to have redundancy and multiple data points. And so having kind of a multifaceted approach evaluation where I'm looking at table stuff, looking at gross movement things, looking at special tests, looking at how they perform under load, like all those things are data points, and they allow me to have kind of just overlapping circles of redundancy. So I don't need to be so specific and have this sort of false sense of precision with one test, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. And the big overarching concept you're talking about is essentially like knowing the research or knowing the evidence but not being so attached to it that you follow it directly without critically thinking about if that research or that evidence-based practice actually fits the person in front of you. Is that kind of summarizing what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, the evidence is that like we don't have great things that are really diagnostic, right? So that's why you need multiple data points. And that in a controlled study, it's really hard to say like, all right, like here's the approach you should take because it's so multifaceted. And a good study, a rigorous study, the idea of it is to like isolate four specific variables, control all the other variables, make sure they're the same so we can test one thing at a time. But real life does not cooperate like that. That's why like when you have a multidisciplinary or multifaceted approach, it's hard to substantiate it with research because it's like definitionally that's not how we study things to prove something works or doesn't work. But the evidence for a lot of what we do is not very good because we're looking at like one thing. And I mean, even as a coach, like you're not ever doing one thing with someone. You're constantly tinkering and trying different things at once. And it's the interaction between the variables is probably the thing that matters most. There isn't one variable that's like omnipotent, but a controlled study is trying to take away those interactive effects and isolate for one variable at a time. And like, again, the real world does not cooperate like that. So I'm not trying to be evasive and say like, I don't look at research, but its research is somewhat limited in its application, especially in our field, because yeah, it's easy to do good research if you're trying to test like one medication for a disease and you're giving someone, you know, a placebo pill and the real medication and everything else is the same. But in our world, I mean, even if you gave two people the exact same program, like they're like internally in terms of their adaptations, they're not going to adapt in the same way to that program. So it's like, it's really hard to do this stuff well.
We interrupt this podcast with a quick reminder that this episode is brought to you by AG1. It's an NSF certified all-in-one superfood supplement that features 75 whole food sourced ingredients designed to support your body's nutritional needs. I use this product daily myself, and a ton of our athletes do as well. Head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim my special offer of 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. AG1 gives you peace of mind that you're covering all your nutritional bases. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, Cressey, and you'll get that special offer.
And that makes total sense. And I know in particular, just from conversations we've had recently before the recording of this, you're working on a book right now on return to sport. If you could talk a little bit about that, that would be great. But in particular, I want to hear you talk more about the research you've gone through on tissue healing and what your biggest takeaways were within that. So first, if you could just give us kind of an overview on what you're working on with the book.
Yeah, I mean, the book is, because I think that we need to have some sort of professional boundaries because you can't be an expert in everything. But I also recognize that a lot of the professional boundaries are more kind of like legally and politically and financially driven than they are practical. And when it comes to return to sport or return to play, whatever people call it, I mean, it's necessarily multidisciplinary and you're going to have, you know, people with a clinical background, whether it's like physical therapists, athletic trainers, even physicians, and you're going to have people with non-clinical backgrounds, more performance backgrounds who are helping athletes to navigate that continuum. And there isn't one profession or one person who kind of like has a monopoly on that knowledge. All that matters is like this, let's try to find this knowledge and make sure that someone is implementing it for the betterment of the athlete, but it's necessarily going to require, you know, domain expertise from different professions. So what we're trying to do is just write a book about like conceptually, how do you get somebody from the point of injury to being able to play in a game? And we tried to write it without like professional lingo. So whether you're a clinician or a non-clinician, it's really more about just principles and concepts. And, you know, it, like if you're comfortable with it and you're a non-clinician, maybe you can do things as long as they're within your scope of practice that maybe typically or traditionally would be more done by a clinician in a physical therapy setting. And conversely, if you're like, you know, typically working more of a clinical setting, and you never envision yourself doing, say, like a return to sprinting progression. Well, if you know, by reading this resource or other resources, if you acquire that knowledge and you're not stepping on somebody else's toes and you're doing it legally and ethically, like here are things that athletes need to be able to perform well after an injury and be prepared for the demands of the game. And so we just tried to write it in a way where it's, you know, sort of professionally neutral, and like, here are the concepts and the progressions and things that we think are important for athletes who are, you know, looking to overcome an injury. So the research for that just like led me to look at, you know, all kinds of things. And one of the things I looked at, because we determined, you know, with the editor that we wanted to have a chapter on tissue healing. And we split the work between, you know, Greg Trevor and I, so we're each essentially writing a third of the book. And one of the chapters that I was assigned was the tissue healing one. And I was like kind of bummed out initially, because I'm like, oh, this is going to be so boring to write about. Because I remember when I was in physical therapy school, and even as an undergrad taking, you know, exercise physiology, you learn about the stages of tissue healing as if they're like these very sort of neat categories. And it's like the inflammation phase and the proliferation phase, the remodeling phase. And it's like, here's the things that happen in each of these phases. And, you know, trying to provide some sort of practical recommendations to adhere to each of those, to adhere to that sequence. But it was always presented as if it was very definitive and very neat. And the more I read about this stuff, the more I'm like, you know, even something that's as simple and intuitive as healing, like when you really dig deep, like what does healing really mean, right? So if we're looking at, and I use kind of like an ACL injury as an example in the book, just because it's pretty prevalent and people kind of understand that. So when someone tears their ACL, and even now there's like a debate going back and forth about, do people need to have ACL surgery or does the ACL heal? And how do we even, first we have to define healing, right? And it seems simple enough, but really the definition only takes you so far, because when we talk about healing in the context of return to sport, what do we really care about? Do we care about the typical definition that involves like, we want to look under a microscope and look for evidence of histological change and histological remodeling? That's the definition of tissue healing, but that's not actually what we care about. Because if I told you, okay, like you, John, you tore your ACL, I have no idea in 12 months from now whether it's healed based on like a tissue biopsy from a high powered microscope. But I can tell you that, you know, in 12 months, you're going to be performing as well as you ever did. And, you know, you're not at risk for a re-tear. Now that's typically not the case after an ACL surgery, but what you really care about in the context of return to sport is, can I function at the level that I once could or at a higher level, regardless of whether or not the tissue has healed? Now, typically we make the assumption that something has to have healed in order for us to regain function. That may or may not be the case, right? Now, we don't have great evidence that ACLs heal without surgery, but that's also because it's really hard to do those studies in a way that would be acceptable to the public. So a lot of the information that we've obtained about tissue healing comes from animal studies that were done a long time ago before we had like sort of ethical guardrails as to what kind of research was permissible. Because if you really want to look at healing directly, you would basically like induce an injury in someone or something. You would, you know, you'd open somebody up, say it was an ACL, you'd open somebody up, you would literally sever their ACL. You wouldn't sew the ACL back together, but you would like sew the joint back together. And then you would wait, and you'd have to control for, are they doing rehabilitation? Are they not? Controlling for all these variables. Let's just say you're trying to test healing in isolation. You would essentially immobilize them, not let them use that limb. And you would reopen them up at, say, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and you would look for evidence of healing. But again, every time you open somebody up, you're doing something invasive. You're having to do follow-on surgeries arthroscopically just to observe that they healed. And then on top of that, we're assuming that we actually are able to observe healing. So we can look at something and be like, oh, the ACL looks like it's approximating coming back together, but we don't do that because it's not that rigorous. So we look under a microscope. But then there are various types of microscopes with various levels of power and magnification, but we're still relying on that technology and kind of our sensory system or our eyes using that technology to say, oh, well, I see more cells here, I see scar tissue here. But, you know, we can't definitively say based on the technology that we have that, oh, well, we know that something is the same as it once was. Like once you've had these kind of injuries, the tissue is never totally the same, but we want to make sure that tissue is functional, right? And the other thing that we would do in the context of ACL healing is once we saw that something looks like it's healed to us, we'd want to say, and this goes for surgery too, we'd want to say, okay, like, how do we know if it's strong enough to withstand sport? Sport is not a controlled environment. You can't do a controlled study on a field. So you would have to, like, again, surgically open people up, and you'd have to try to induce an ACL tear in them, whether that's, like, you know, with some kind of machine, right? You do, like, kind of a really crazy Lachman's test or anterior drawer, and you would try to measure, you know, what's the failure point of the ACL in someone who either has had surgery or not had surgery. Because what you really care about in this context is not healing, looking under a microscope and cell proliferation. You care about, all right, like, what is that tensile strength of the ACL under load via all of the possible injury mechanisms, whether it's, you know, frontal plane, rotational. We typically, like, in the clinic do, you know, kind of more of like a anterior posterior type of a test. That's not how people tear their ACL in the real world. So even our clinical tests are kind of detached from what happens in the field. So, you know, I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but the takeaway is healing is kind of a very ambiguous, sometimes problematic construct. We don't necessarily, like, know exactly how to measure it. We don't have perfect technology to identify it. And it's also not the thing that we truly care about. We truly care about function. We care about function and pain. And so if we could tell people, like, all right, I can't guarantee you're healed, but you're going to be pain-free and you're going to be completely functional and your ACL won't be a factor, they would be happy with that, even if we couldn't look under do a tissue biopsy of them and say that, you know, histologically your ACL looks the same as your uninjured one. So, and in a lot of these studies, even on ACL healing, they're taking very superficial biopsy samples because they don't want to take deep biopsy samples because they don't want to insult where they did the surgery and they don't want to insult the graft. So even to look at, you know, tissue healing and, like, graft remodeling after a surgery on a deep level, you have to do invasive things that might actually compromise the graft. So can we look at a superficial biopsy sample, as is typically done in these graft remodeling studies, and say, well, you know, based on this very superficial tissue sample, you're healed? But that's why when you hear things like, you know, the ACL doesn't heal for 2 years, how we came to that conclusion, I'm always like, well, how do we know that, right? We take certain things at face value. I'm like, well, how do we know? And I actually dug into all these research studies, and basically where the 2 years comes from is in some of these samples that they've done, these biopsy samples, they find examples of histological remodeling up until 2 years. Now, based on that research, which is inherently very imperfect, but the best that we can do without hurting people and doing something really invasive, and we're doing it in kind of an ethical way, right? We're not, like, going back in and hacking them back up and trying to re-tear their ACL, where we don't want to hurt them in a study. So we're looking at, what does this tissue look like under a microscope, as imperfect as it is? Does that mean that we should tell people that they shouldn't return to sport for 2 years? Now, that's what some people will actually say. There are some researchers who are saying, well, based on what we know about graft remodeling in some of these tissue biopsy studies, we recommend that athletes don't return to full competition for 2 years. I don't know if I have enough faith in this research to make that statement. And, you know, they've also found in some epidemiological studies that athletes, you know, like, typically have the highest re-tear rates, you know, right before, like, going up until 2 years. And then at 2 years, it kind of stabilizes and you see less re-tears. But even if we took that to be totally true, as far as, like, we're saying we have faith in this research and we're willing to make a determination based on it, which, as I've said, the research is imperfect. Like, are you going to tell, let's say, a high school athlete who probably has no aspirations of playing sports after high school, let's say they tear their ACL as a sophomore, right? Are you going to tell them, well, you shouldn't play sports the rest of your high school career because you're more likely to tear your ACL within 2 years of the surgery? Or based on some of this histological research, we find examples of graft remodeling up until 2 years. That becomes kind of more of, like, a, you know, a discussion to be had with the athlete, because, yes, like, we can do probabilities based on people re-tear their ACLs, you know, up until 2 years at various timelines. But, as, like, if you told me in high school, I'm more likely to tear my ACL within 2 years, but you know, I could play after 9 months or 12 months and I could salvage one last year of high school athletics and I'm never going to play high school athletics again. Like, that's a risk that I'll be willing to take. So it's not just about what are the probabilities and the odds and what does the research say? It's what are the athlete's values? That's the whole like kind of athlete centric care. I mean, I think it's our job as coaches and clinicians to tell people kind of like what the risks are and what the data says. And we also need to be honest about how we got that data and what the limitations of that data are, because even if we present it with data, if that data is gathered in kind of an imperfect way, which all of our data is, and we have to be honest about like, where are the uncertainties in the data and what are the assumptions that we made with regard to healing? How do we measure healing? There's so much uncertainty even behind these numbers that we're giving people. When we say 2 years, we present it as if it's this hard thing, like you have to wait 2 years or healing occurs up until 2 years, but there's a story behind that number. Every number has a story, and we owe it to our athletes and our patients to tell people, you know, what's the story behind that number, so they can make the best decision for themselves based on their values. Now, certainly if I thought, you know, if someone tore their ACL and had surgery and wanted to go back and play in a month, I would say, like, I think that's a really stupid idea, but most people wouldn't even want to do that. But then if it comes down to, you know, like I had a girl very recently who was like 8 months post-op and she wanted to like play her entire soccer season. Like, is 8 months ideal? Probably not, but she only has 2 more years left of eligibility. She's not going to play professionally. And she's like kind of willing to take that risk as opposed to waiting 12 months or 15 months. Because if she waits 3 more months, then now we're getting into, you know, September, October, November. Then she'd basically be able to play her season for like 2 weeks, right? So the real world is just so messy. And that's why these conversations need to be had, because even with these numbers that we present, I'm just not a fan of false precision. And as you know, in our field, everything now is so data-driven. And if you give someone a number, it's like, okay, I'm off the hook. We have a number, everything's clean. But these numbers are not clean. There's a story behind them. And I remember reading a quote one time, someone said, you know, math or numbers are like any language, and you can lie to people in any language. So we've got to really tell people like, all right, what does this number mean? So that they can decide, because ultimately, whether it's the athlete or the clinician or the coach, human beings are making decisions based on imperfect information. And that's never going to change no matter how much data we get, because the data itself is always imperfect. And that's why ultimately, to come full circle here, I ended up enjoying that chapter on tissue healing, because I wrote what I think is the chapter that most people do not write, which is like, yeah, like here's what we know, but it's more about what we don't know. And so we're not giving people false precision when it comes to something like healing, because we're not willing to do these studies in a way that would really tell us what we want to know, because we're not going to cut people up and then reinduce all these injuries and then, you know, see what happens. It's not ethical. And there's a reason why we don't do that. Thankfully, we don't live in a world where we treat people, you know, like we treated animals 100 years ago. Thankfully, we don't even treat animals like that anymore, right? But it's really hard to do ethically validated studies that tell you everything you want to know. And if you look back at even like World War II, you know, what was being done in Germany, like a lot of the things that we know about the extremes of human physiology came from that. But it was done in a way that like we would deem to be unacceptable. And that's why those doctors were prosecuted and accused of war crimes. But like, how do you really know how cold somebody can get before they die without like literally pushing people, giving them hypothermia to the point of death and finding out what that breaking point is? Otherwise, it's all theoretical, right? Now, again, I'm glad we're not doing that research, but some of the stuff when it comes to healing and these like extremes of physiology, it's hard to do good research without doing harm to people.
Doug, that was awesome. A ton of detail within that. I'm sure listeners will get a ton out of the last, I think it was 10, somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes, but just a lot of detail on, you know, not only, you know, using the data, but questioning the data and figuring out if the data fits the person in front of you. You know, and it sounds like you've done a ton of work on that. So I know I'm excited to dive into that chapter of the book. We'll dive into the book as a whole, but especially that chapter. I want to at least try to make it a little more practical in terms of the examples you're giving. How often do you find yourself in a scenario where the doctor provides one timeline, or someone in the person's inner circle, whether it's the doctor or a parent or a sport coach, provides a timeline that you wind up disagreeing with based off what you know in front of you? And how do you go about navigating that conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think that when it comes to what you're really kind of asking is like, how do you know when someone's ready to go back? Like, when do you feel safe having an athlete return to sport? And I don't think that the time, you can't use time alone, right? Because even like, let's say theoretically you did nothing with somebody after an ACL surgery. They were like immobilized, sat on the couch, did nothing, but they did that for 2 years. So we could say, oh, well, based on the research, the ACLs heal after 2 years. That's an extreme case, but extremes can be illuminating. We'd be like, well, that's ridiculous because you're not functionally ready for the demands of the game. You haven't done any strength work. You haven't done any change of direction work. If you've been immobilized, your knee probably can't even fully, you know, flex or extend. You haven't done any conditioning. You're not like just in general shape to have, you know, your general ability manifest in a sport specific way. But conversely, I don't think we can only rely on function either. I mean, you know, typically function and time go hand in hand, but if barring an extreme case, like let's say it's someone, you know, who tears their ACL, has surgery, and like the Olympics is 4 or 5 months away, and like they're willing to blow their knee out again because it's their last Olympics, like that's a different example. But let's say it's more like, you know, high school, college sports, and it's not like those kind of stakes. You know, I've had people who like even at 5 or 6 months look really good and they're very functional, and I could have them do hop tests and strength tests, and they might even be superior to where some of their peers are in the same sport who haven't had a surgery or a significant injury. But, you know, typically at 5 or 6 months, unless there's like a really good reason, like the Olympic athlete who wants to compete in the Olympics in 5 months, I'm not that comfortable telling someone to go back after 5 or 6 months, no matter how good they look in the various tests. So for me, it's a combination of like, I want them to meet certain functional benchmarks. That's typically like a non-negotiable, unless again, it's someone who's like, look, it's the championship. This is my life. This is how I make money. And I'm willing to go into the game or into the competition, like not 100% prepared because like, this is my life and I've got nothing else and I'm willing to take the risk. But you know, besides those extreme cases, like I want people to meet certain functional milestones before they're able to play. Cause it makes intuitive sense, right? Like if you tell someone like, yeah, you know, it's been 10 months or 12 months, your doctor says you could play based on that timeline. But if you are playing a change of direction sport, like you literally can't even hop on one leg, you can't get 2 inches off the ground either because of pain or inhibition or just lack of elasticity or strength. Like it makes sense that it's you, even if you don't hurt per se, like you're going to be able to perform well because you're just not capable of the output that's required to be competitive. So typically it's some combination of like, I want them to meet functional milestones and then also time. And that's where the judgment comes in because like this person I work with very recently who's back at school now, like, yeah, she was at 8 or 9 months, which is kind of like at the earlier end of the timeline where I feel like comfortable having somebody go back. But because she met those functional milestones, I'm like, all right, like that's probably, you know, as far as the intersection between time and function, 8-9 months is probably like at the low end of where when I want someone to go back. But typically I'm a little bit more comfortable at like 12 to 15, but me, you know, assuming that they met the same functional milestones. But you know, beyond 15, it's like, yes, if you were a betting person and you had to bet your life that somebody wasn't going to re-tear their ACL, I'd probably wait 2 years, assuming they're doing all the rehab and meeting those functional milestones. But we're talking about like small numbers here. And, you know, when we talk, like if you even hear somebody say, you know, I'm making this number up, I don't know exactly what it is, but if you say like, you are twice as likely, all things being equal, to re-tear your ACL, you know, at say 12 months, as you are at 24 months, that sounds like a really big number. Like you're twice as likely. But you also have to look at like absolute versus relative risk. If the, you know, if the absolute risk at 12 months is you have like say a 2 out of 100 chance of tearing it based on the available data. But if you wait, let's say at 12 months, it's like 4 out of 100, right? Based on the available data. But then if you wait, you know, 24 months, it's 2 out of 100. it's like, yes, it's twice as much, but it's still 4% versus 2%. So you've got to differentiate absolute versus relative risk. And in a lot, you know, when you're trying to make a point about something, if you have an agenda, and that goes with a lot of things, you're typically only going to talk about relative risk and not absolute risk, because it's easier to scare people with the relative risk versus the absolute risk. But again, you know, one person might be comfortable with 4 out of 100% chance. Somebody else might not be. And again, these are other people. This isn't you. This is based on other people with similar injuries, but they're still not you. So that's where there's just so much, like I said, there's so much gray when it comes to this stuff. And that's why it needs to be a conversation between all the stakeholders, all the people involved in the rehab, strength and conditioning, athletic trainer, physical therapist, physician, athlete. It's not just like one person deciding unilaterally, because we just can't say definitively, like, what is that magic number? What is that magical intersection between time and function? We just don't know.
No, that's awesome. And hopefully listeners got a lot out of, you know, the last 15, 20 minutes. I know, like I said, I'm looking forward to diving into the book. What is your anticipated timeline on the book? When can we expect to be available to purchase it?
Well, I think we're supposed to have the rough draft of the manuscript done in like maybe 2 months. So sometime before the holidays. And then after that is the editing process. So I'm guessing it might take between 8 months and a year to do all the editing, from my understanding. But, you know, hopefully like a year from now, maybe like next fall or the summer would be great. But it's kind of like, it's on us to get it done. So every time people ask me that, it's like a reminder to write it. Cause you know, we're not full-time authors, so we have to find time to do it on the side, and, you know, between work and kids and stuff like that, it's hard, but it's good having these conversations because it puts pressure on us to hold ourselves accountable. This needs to get done. Yeah, otherwise we're promising something that we're not going to do.
Yeah. This is going to be public now. So you're going to have multiple people texting you about it, trying to figure out when it's coming out, but
you're outing us. Shame is the best motivator, you know? Yeah.
Well, no, hopefully it's something, you know, if it comes out in a year, year and a half, whatever it is, that, you know, I can dive into, we can have you back on, talk about, you know, different things that I found interesting in it that we didn't even bring up here. So I'm sure there's a lot of good information in there that, you know, we didn't have a chance to touch upon here. I want to get into kind of a few quick questions here before we're done. We can have a little fun in the last 5 minutes or so. But obviously you're one-on-one PT, so you're trying to essentially, you know, you don't spend the whole 60 minutes or whole 90 minutes, however long you're with somebody, talking about their injury and the exercise you're about to do. So what is the movie that you recommend to patients to watch the most often, and why?
Great question. It's What About Bob with Bill Murray. Because, you know, I work with a lot of people who have like kind of chronic pain where there's a little bit of a disconnect between maybe, you know, the actual injury and the sort of the perception of threat or the perception of injury. You know, I kind of liken it to a smoke alarm. Like, you want the smoke alarm in your house to go off when the house is on fire, not when you're boiling water on the stove. And, you know, in chronic pain, you could have people where there's a really disproportionate alarm signal. Maybe they had like, you know, they hurt their back 10 years ago, but they still act like it's the moment that they hurt their back doing whatever they were doing. And I, you know, a lot of this becomes like, there's, you know, there's a huge psychosocial component to pain, especially non-acute pain. And What About Bob, I think, is a very light movie that can help people to sort of sometimes like have a little bit more of a sense of humor about their situation and maybe open up a little bit of a door to have a conversation about maybe how kind of some of their thoughts and beliefs might be influencing their clinical presentation. Not to suggest their pain isn't real or to trivialize it, but that, you know, it's not all physical and that they don't need to necessarily be afraid of, you know, if they bend over and pick something up, but their back is going to go out because their back is structurally fine. But maybe it's their, you know, it's their interpretation of their body and maybe their perception of fragility that's driving how they feel and not so much something that's more structural.
Sure. That makes sense. I knew that would somehow get back to a like more, I guess, clinical or more like science type response here. It wouldn't just be like a discussion on like favorite Bill Murray movies. So I figured it was an appropriate question. Do you guys have like a section in the book or an anticipated section in the book, like on pain science or on patient care, client communication, stuff like that? Or is it
more? Yeah, we are. I mean, it's not going to be a huge emphasis only because we want to make it as practical as possible. And the reality is, like, a lot of the pain science stuff that I read, it's like, you could read a whole book on it, but I could also tell you what you need to know in like two pages, you know? And it's, with any of these things, like, they all play a role, but I think that they've done research showing this, like, say we're talking about, you know, returning to play after a surgery. It's very hard to differentiate physical preparation from psychological, because if you use the right physical progressions, people are going to become more confident and psychologically more ready to play. I mean, I kind of look at it like the burden is on me as the provider to have you do things in our controlled rehab setting that give you confidence, so that when you go play, you're not like, oh, well, like, I'm scared because I've never really tested my leg. Like, we're going to do, you know, we're going to be sprinting, changing direction. Like, we're not going to play a soccer game in the clinic. But as far as the physical pieces, I'd like to believe that we have a pretty systematic approach where we can get people to meet the physical demands of the game, not so much maybe like the tactical and the technical, but where they can trust that, okay, like, my body can make a cut with full intent and react to an opponent, and I'm not worried about my knee buckling. So, you know, yes, like, I have conversations that purely focus on like mindset and the psychological piece, but I think with rehab, especially post-op, like, if people feel vulnerable and lack confidence, to me, that's reflects a lack of imagination on the provider as far as the progressions they're using. Because if you're using the right progressions, they're going to be confident when they play in most cases.
Sure, that makes sense. So a little pivot here. So I know your wife has hiked Mount Everest, correct?
Yeah.
Yep. You made a living out of jumping out of planes for years, which I don't know how much you want to get into there, but I'll let you speak on that for 30 seconds to a minute if you want. And then I know you were one of the reasons we had to kind of push back this podcast was you were skiing in South America. So what is left on the bucket list for the two of you?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, I like to believe that I'm the kind of person that if I want to do something, I'll do it. And I'm not, especially the older I get, like, I don't have the attitude like, oh, well, I'll be able to do this later, because later is not, I'm not trying to be like fatalistic and say I might not be alive. I mean, that's possible, but even something as simple as like the physical stuff, like all the skiing that I do and the outdoors things, like when I'm 65 years old and my kids are in college, like, even if I have the time and the money to do those kind of things, I'm probably not going to be as physically capable. So if I want to go on like a crazy ski trip, like, now is the time to do it, even though it's not ideal in terms of, you know, I'm not in the prime of my career financially and I've got young kids, but like, my body is not going to be, you know, I'm not going to get better and healthier when I'm 65. So I recently read this book called Die with Zero, and it talks about, you know, like, how we just like have this attitude that we're going to like save everything for later. But the things that are typically most meaningful are you can enjoy them more when you're younger. So like, do them when you can. So yeah, like, there's probably some trips that I want to be able to do that, you know, it'll be easier to do maybe when I have more time, whenever that is. But for the most part, like, if I really want to do something, I try to do it right now, because nothing is really really guaranteed. And I would say most of like my sort of bucket list things probably involve just doing things with my kids at certain ages. And like, I can't do them now. Like, I have to wait for them to be able to do them, you know. But as far as like for myself, like, I've pretty much done most of them. And if something, you know, strikes my fancy and like I decide I want to do it, I'll probably do it sooner than later and not wait.
Sure. You know, it makes perfect sense. I'll have to check out that book. You said it's Die with Zero.
Die with Zero. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I'll look into it. But Doug, last minute or two here, what's the best way for listeners to contact you?
Yeah. Probably like our website, resilientperformance.com. That's a good place to start. And then our social media, we're on Instagram, resilientPPT is the handle. We have a YouTube channel, so Resilient Performance Physical Therapy. And then the only social media that I'm individually active on is Twitter, and my handle there is GreenFeetPT. Sure. So yeah, any of those places, you know, it's a good place to reach out.
And then for people, if you're listening and looking into, hey, maybe like I need a PT, or you know someone who needs a PT, my understanding is you're in Southern Connecticut a few days a week, you're in New York City a couple other days a week, and then your business has locations in New York City, New Jersey, and Connecticut, correct?
Yeah. So if you, anybody like near New York City, Darien, Connecticut, Chatham, New Jersey, Wharton, New Jersey, and then hopefully soon to be Rye, New York. So kind of like that tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. We'll have you covered. We'll have someone there that can take care of you.
Sure. Awesome. Well, you know, hopefully a few people reach out. I know, you know, from knowing you guys for years, you guys do an excellent job, and hopefully listeners got a lot out of this podcast. I know I did. I know I'm excited to, you know, talk to you more about some stuff you learned about, and hopefully in a more official way, bring you back on when the book is out.
Yeah, no, it's always fun chatting, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you, Doug.
All right. Take care.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. We really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to listen, not just to this episode, but also to some of the episodes from our archives. If you enjoy what you heard, we'd love it if you'd share it with friends, colleagues, and teammates, as well as leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks again for your time.